Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
It's so much more than just a profile picture. At Catholic Singles, our platform offers you many opportunities to get to know the person behind the picture. Sign up today at CatholicSingles.com.
Good News Ministries of GNM.org. It's the Catholic place for growing your faith. Good News Ministries will provide you with faith-building reflections, virtual retreats, prayer resources, and lots more. All of it is free. Visit GNM.org today.
Well, hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Lisa Hendy and Friends. I always love being joined by fellow storytellers, and this week we have a phenomenal one joining us. Chad Stewart is a native of Newport Beach, California, currently living way down south in San Diego. He's a strong supporter of education and the arts with an amazing, amazing background as a producer, an international consultant, and a prominent speaker. And he's here today to join us to discuss a wonderful new book entitled Britfield and the Lost Crown, not only the book, but also the importance of literacy, creativity, storytelling, and more. Welcome to the show, Chad.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a treat. You know, before we dive into talking about the book, I always like to kind of find out a little bit more about my new friends and to hear a little bit more about your story. So let us know a little bit just about how you got to this point in your life and in your career.
Sure. I'm originally from Newport Beach, California, and then I was actually back east for 16 years, Wellesley, Massachusetts, about 20 minutes outside of Boston. Did some of my undergraduate and graduate work there, and then worked in business. I was actually in banking and investment for a while. So, yikes! But far cry from creativity.
Hey, I have a son who works for a hedge fund, so don't.
Okay. yeah.
Believe me that it can be good fodder for stories.
Oh, yeah.
But massive career shift, huh?
Yeah, so it was. It was great. I love New England. It was a lot of fun. I mean, it's crazy because 16 years, that's a long stint. But it was great, and I love New England, and I love, obviously, the seasons in the fall. I traveled a lot during that time, which was great. But I've always been creative. I've always had just a great creative spark. And I think so many students and even college students, they're kind of in this mindset where it's like, you know, you got to have the safe job. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you get a lot of really, quite frankly, bad advice. It's like, you know, don't be an artist. You'll never do art. You know, don't be a musician. You're not going to, you know, play, you know, record music. And so we kind of take the safe bet. And so I think I did that quite a bit. But just the creative spark was inside me. And so I've always loved writing. I've been writing since I was 12. And I think for me, that was kind of the first official kickoff of quote unquote my writing career. But I got into script writing when I was sort of in my 18, 19, 20. Mm-hmm. And so I actually started writing scripts because I loved movies. I loved storytelling. And so I thought script writing was kind of a great base for it. I worked with a lot of professional script writers, which were great, more as mentors that helped me, you know, with the craft, and did quite a few scripts. But I think I got burned out on it because it's very stringent, to say the very least.
And, oh, yes. And,
yeah. When you want to express yourself or carry on, you know, with a paragraph or, you know, direction of the story, you don't do that in a script, really. And I remember getting checked, you know, as I was like on a third or fourth draft, and I might have a note that says this song is playing. And then one of the professional script writers would say, no, the producer picks the music. And then I'd say they walked into the room and he did this, and they're like, no, you're directing, and the director will do that. And so it's just, you know, it was, and then like this paragraph of describing this, yeah, just make sure it's three lines. And it was that kind of thing. And it was great training. In fact, I'm blessed for that because it helped me with structure, the three act structure and pacing. But it just, you know, I really wanted to kind of explode forward. And I think, that's really how Britfield and Lost Crown started, if you can believe it, you know, 10 years ago. And we can kind of get into that. But that's kind of an overview. You know, like I said, Newport Beach, and then I was in back east for about 16 years and did my graduate and undergraduate and then worked in banking and investment. So,
and then made the journey back to California full circle.
Yeah, huh? I did. And I drove too. It was kind of fun. I did it in like 5 days. I took the I-80.
Oh, so. That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, you know, well, as a fellow writer, I congratulate you on the path of your life. But I also recognize in my own work that God's so good, and he always plants little seeds that we need along the way to, that are going to blossom into whatever we're doing. And it sounds like, you know, even though there were some years that you weren't actively creating, you were still, you know, gathering some of the skills that you'd need to do exactly what it is that you're doing right now, which is launching this amazing new series. And specifically with the launch of the first book of this series, Britfield and the Lost Crown, tell us a little bit more about kind of what this book is about, but larger what the world of Britfield is all about.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's interesting. It started as an idea 10 years ago, and there I was in New England. I was actually working for an investment house at the time, and I was down on this weekend seminar, very boring, and I started to drift, and I started to doodle, and I doodled this circle, and then three lines, a basket, a boy and a girl, just a simple doodle. And I kind of put the title, The Boy in the Balloon. And here we are 10 years later. And that's how this whole thing started. I just, for some reason, and we all have those moments that it just resonated with me. I thought, what a cool story. You know, a couple of orphans, Tom and Sarah, takes place in England. They're up at this, you know, very oppressive orphanage called Weatherly. And this is the year that Tom escapes, and he's not leaving until he leaves with his best friend, Sarah. And so somewhere along the line, they commandeer a hot air balloon. And I thought that would make a really cool story. And so that's kind of how the whole thing started. Went home that weekend, outlined it like three quarters of a page, just bullet points. I was kind of outlining, and I said, okay, they go here and they go here, and then Oxford, Windsor, London, and then they end down to the south of England. And so I kind of just mapped it out. And at that moment, and it's very interesting, but at that moment I knew that this was going to be the rest of my life. I knew that this was going to be a huge project, and that we would have amazing reach. And so it took me 4 years, 2,500 hours to write book one, Britfield and Lost Crown. It's part of a 7-book series. In book one, Tom and Sarah are both 12. And then as the story progresses in book two, they're in France and they're 13. In book three, they'll be in Italy and they're 14. Russia will be book five. China will be book. I'm sorry. Russia will be book four, and then Russia will be. China will be book five, and then they come back full circle to the United States by book seven. So that's kind of an outline of the story. But what's great about it is book one is 384 pages. Takes place in England, and it takes place in present time. And I think that's what's kind of neat about it. You have so many of these futuristic books out there. You have so many of these sort of fantasy books out there. And everything about Britfield and the Lost Crown, to some extent, is grounded in reality. All the locations that they go are real locations, the one-way streets, the hotels, the places, the history, the culture. So everything about Britfield, set aside from obviously the name Britfield and the history that we kind of weave throughout, is accurate and real. And I think that's exciting because you have so much fantasy out there, probably 80-90% of the market. And while it's an entertaining, there's also a disconnect, in my opinion, you know, with the reader, and especially the children or the students in this case, because they're never really going to relate to these characters. They don't have magical powers, you know what I mean? So they can't fly, you know, they're not vampires, they can't wave a wand, they can't do all these, they're not demigods, they're not all these, you know, things that are kind of put it out there. So what I love about it is I think so many girls and so many, you know, girls can relate to Sarah. So many boys can relate to Tom. And it's a very, very creative book, too, in the sense that it's a great communication book. Tom and Sarah are sort of talking all the time, great communication. They're figuring out things, a lot of critical thinking, trying to, you know, and they make mistakes along the way and they learn from these mistakes. And it's just, it's really anchored in that sense of reality. And I think that's what makes it very powerful. At 384 pages, we've had a 12-year-old read the book in 5 hours.
Wow.
So, which is our record to date. Our youngest reader is 7 years old. Our oldest reader is 93, who loved it, read it in 5 hours. We had a retired doctor, 87 years old, that took it to Palm Springs with his friends, and they all loved it. They all read it in 5 hours. So we're finding this amazing, you know, impact with Britfield. And this transition, you know, to the age group. And as you know, young adult audience, 55% of the young adult audience are actually adults, mm-hmm. anyway. So
yeah.
It doesn't completely surprise us. But it's been amazing. The feedback has been amazing. We've won multiple awards, national and international awards. We just won a couple weeks ago another national first place award for best juvenile fiction. And it's just the feedback's been amazing. The awards has been amazing. The reviews has been amazing. And that's kind of a quick overview, and then we can talk about sort of the Brickfield Empire, if you will.
Yeah. So I want to ask specifically about setting this in England. And I'm as one who loves to travel, I love hearing about the plans for the future books. What kind of research did you do? Have you spent a lot of time over there? Did you were you able to kind of go over and focus on the feel of the place as you wrote? Or is it internet research? Or how did you capture like the heart of England?
Sure. No, great questions too. And they say two things about writing: write about what you know and write about what you love. And part of that is because it's a long journey. So you want to know, you know, you want to enjoy what you're doing. But I had, I spent about 2 years off and on in England. So I knew it very well. And all the places that Tom and Sarah go to are places that I have visited. Everything from the Duke's Hotel in St. James, where they stay. I've stayed there, and they have tea at the Brown Hotel, and I've had tea there and stayed there. And so it's really based on a lot of my own journey and a lot of the fun that I've had there. So it's based on that. I was a British literature major for undergraduate and a European history major. So I have done a lot of research and been influenced by a lot of British writers, and then also did a lot of internet
yeah.
research. And I laugh because it's like we've come so far, and you can remember maybe even, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, these authors would have to log off to the library, right?
Oh, yeah.
And be flipping through books and card catalogs. And now it's like when I'm describing Trinity College, you know, at Oxford, I just, you know, go on the internet, Google it, I pull it up, and then I'm digitally looking at it. You know how they have it where you can tour it.
Oh, yeah.
And
walk,
you know, and go in a 360. And so I'm literally doing that now. And I'm writing as I'm watching it, describing, you know, the windows and the brick. And I mean, you know, as much vivid detail as I can give it, but it's amazing. So
yeah.
Like the technology now and the internet and the computers, you know, just it's made our job so much easier and faster. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you're talking about when two of my books for children are set in Assisi, and I've never had the joy of going there, but I did the same thing because I have a scene in one of my books where they're running, you know, from the Basilica out to the outskirts of Assisi. And I basically used Google Maps and the satellite view and the street yep. view and ran along with my cursor as fast as I could. And what I'm thinking about for the kids who will read your books, that when they eventually make it over to England, they will have this like laundry list of places that they want to go visit that'll be on the Brickfield tour of places that they can go see. So that's so cool. One thing I wanted to ask you about is the concept of agency. So when I started writing for children, I had never done that before. And when I was very gifted to have a great kidlit editor who taught me about the idea of agency, where she kept telling me in my character development that I was making the mistake of not letting the child characters in my book have enough control over the action in the book, that they should have the agency to control their own destiny. And it was a big learning curve for me, but also a great gift, because it helped me to realize not only in my writing, but my interaction with kids, that oftentimes we rob them of their agency. We rob them of the ability to kind of be, you know, have a voice in their destiny and truly a voice in making our world a better place. And I know that part of your goal for these books is not just, you know, to write a book that somebody will read once, but to be equipping young people, you know, to kind of claim their destiny. You do school visits and things like that. So say a little bit about why your characters have so much heart and why that's critical to the mission of Brickfield.
Yeah, God, you said so much there that we could get into. But yeah, I think one of the things that I do with the story and Brickfield and the characters is I think too many authors do this, and they over-describe things. And I don't know if it's just a need that they need to show that they're very poetic as writers. But I think I'm all into story. And so I think when you start a book, it's like starting at the open end of a funnel, you know, and you kind of open it up and you're describing stuff. But I think as you start to move the story forward, your description's a lot tighter. And what I do is I leave a lot of that open for the readers to fill in. And point in fact is like the balloon. I describe the outline of the balloon, the structure of the balloon. I never actually describe the color of the balloon. And so what I'm doing is I'm calling on the reader to fill it in for themselves. I'll frame out, you know, a certain scene and stuff, but I don't get into the dripping early morning dew and, you know, the flowers. Do you know what I mean? And it's like I've read so many books like this, and I feel that most of those books are like they're 400 pages of paper or 400 page count, but there's only about 180 pages of story, and the rest is just fluff. It's just too much description, and I look at that a lot as speed bumps. So we write tight, but I think I've also based my characters on people that I know or that have inspired me, sometimes directly. Professor Hainsworth, which is a wonderful character, he's based on a couple of professors that I've actually had in the past, you know, at undergraduate. So it's not always like one person, but certain characteristics of them. I know Sarah was based on a certain person that I had met and known in England, which was kind of cool. And then I think Detective Gowerstone, ironically, is, you know, he's kind of based a little bit on Sherlock Holmes, a little bit on James Bond. So you kind of have those kind of fun crossovers. Am I answering the question?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. And disregard the any distractions that may happen during the course of a podcast. So I think that's really great. I want to ask you, there are themes of faith that kind of abound in Britfield. Was that intentional? And how is that part of, because this is a book that's being read in all kinds of different settings, not just places of faith, but how were you edified by faith themes in the Britfield series?
No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a mainstream book, but it's really based on biblical principles, if you will, family values. If someone were to ask me what's the main theme of Britfield, I'd say it's all about family. It's about family, friendship, courage. It doesn't have any kind of agenda. It doesn't compromise anything. And there's just nothing offensive about it, if you will. I think it's a very edifying, encouraging, inspiring, and uplifting book without being overt about it, which obviously you have a lot of that out there, too, especially on the film side. It's like it's either there really is no middle ground. You know what I mean? It's either like hardcore Hollywood or sort of B-rated, you know, Christian films. That's just kind of in your face, and they're almost hard to watch if you can even watch them. So I think I like to think of my book more like kind of The Blind Side. You know, that was just a great movie that crossed over all the demographics, and it was just about a family that helped out a senior football player. And I actually use that as an example when I'm giving our school presentations. So yeah, I think it's important. It's powerful, but it's not overt, and I don't think it needs to be. And
that's great, and just something that's enjoyable that you don't have to worry about giving to your kid to read or reading yourself. That's awesome. One of the things that you talk about in discussing Britfield is the four C's, and I want to get into that a little bit and sure. Have you kind of tell me how, you know, the power of a good book to express something like the four C's. What are they, and how does reading and literacy help us to capture those?
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because our theme is that Britfield's more than a book. It's a movement. And, you know, this is 10 years in the making, 4 years to write, 2,500 hours for book one. I've assembled an extraordinary team of highly gifted people. We've got about 15 people that are working on Britfield right now, and this you know national launch. We really officially launched in August, and we're just now rolling into it. We did a pilot school program back in spring, and we did 39 schools, 4,500 students, public, charter, private, and even homeschool groups. And so it's more than a book. And our big push, our big passion is all about creativity and bringing creativity back into the classroom, instilling in the teachers' minds along with the students of how important creativity is. And it's really one of these wonderful gifts that, frankly, God has given all of us. We're all creative. He's all given us this amazing individuality and this creative gift. And just because we don't feel creative, we all have that talent. And some might be more, you know, creative artists, but creativity is in everything. It's in science, it's in mathematics, it's in all those things. And unfortunately, those are the classes that first get cut, and they know that. They realize that they've made a massive mistake. It's my opinion that in the next 3 to 5 years, that creativity will be the single most important skill set to have, not just in college, but in the business world. And just to give you a point, LinkedIn just did a research analysis that said creativity is the number one skill of 2019.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? And I could say, if we have time, I can tell you some of the quotes and stuff, because everything that we're doing, everything we're talking about is based on really 8 to 10 years worth of research. And it's kind of like we as a nation are in a creative crisis right now, or a creativity crisis. We have been for the last 20 years. And what does that mean? It means in 10 specific areas of creativity. And that's everything from communication, critical thinking. We've been dropping and been on a massive decline for 20 years. So like if you're to look at a chart, you'd see almost a line going at a 45 degree angle. It doesn't spike, it doesn't platform. So kids are becoming less and less creative. And yet on the other side of it, you're having, research, statistics that like the World Economic Forum says that creativity will be one of the top three skills by 2020. You have the IBM survey of 1,500 CEOs that say that creativity is the number one leadership quality of the future. You have an Adobe study on creativity that says that hiring managers across the board for creative applicants 5-1 over non-creative applicants. And you can go on and on and on. I mean, all the statistics are there. So on one side, you have a nation that's in a creativity crisis. It has been for 20 years. And on the other side of it is creativity is more than likely going to be the number one top skill within the next 3 to 5 years. You also have another thing that we're fighting against, which I would call the AI crisis. And just to give you some stats, in the next 5 to 10 years, 95% of all accounting jobs will be obsolete. Let that sink in for a minute.
Wow.
It's like, wow, right? 40 to 50% of all engineering and architectural jobs will be obsolete in the next 5 to 10 years. 50% of all banking jobs will be obsolete. But the one thing that AI cannot replace is creativity. And so, you know, as schools are pushing, you know, all the hard subjects and, oh, you got to get into accounting and mathematics, and there's nothing against that. But most of those jobs, unfortunately, are going to be obsolete, you know, whether you like it or not, you know. And so creativity is such a key skill to have in the future. So that's why we're really kind of pushing this. So we've just launched our fall tour 2019. I've already done 4 schools. We're doing 16 states and 125 schools in the next 3 months. So we're excited. We're headed all the way up towards you, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Santa Barbara, San Francisco. Then we're getting into Oregon, Washington, working our way through Colorado, over to Iowa, back down through Oklahoma, and then through Arizona, and then back to California. So I'm really excited. So, you know, it is more than a book. So we can lead. We get into these schools, private and public, throughout the nation right now. And we have this wonderful presentation, and we come in as an award-winning author. We come in with this exciting, you know, book and book series. But really, I spend about 85% of my time in the presentations talking to the students about creativity, about the importance of creativity, about writing. And they're grounded in a lot of reality. It's not flash over substance. I tell them, and here's 12-year-olds, right? Here's 11-year-olds. And I tell them, I say that, you know, most overnight successes take anywhere from 1 to 2 decades to succeed. And so I say those type of things. I talk about one of the most important aspects about creativity is not being afraid to fail. And then I talk about failure. And I talk about if you're not willing to risk anything, you're not willing to learn anything. And I say, if you fail, fail fast. If you fall, fall forward. And I talk about, you know, some of the things we've done. And then I use, you know, great examples like Pixar. And I kick it off with Toy Story and how Pixar kicked around for, you know, 15 years as an idea. And no one believed it, you know, but they believed in their idea. And all of a sudden, you know, 4 years to write Toy Story, they launch it. And now it's like it was a huge success. And practically everything Pixar has done has been hugely successful. I talk about Star Wars, you know, and how George Lucas kicked it around the studios and everyone thought it was ridiculous and would never work, you know. And so I love it because there's these wonderful things. Here we are 45 years later, still talking about Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it still continues. And it's just like, you know, what if he believed what everyone else said and just said, you know what, maybe they're right. Maybe my idea isn't great. And I'm just going to shelve this thing. It's just so they're really just these great, powerful presentations where it's like it's just instilling in kids. And it's hitting them on, and I'll come back to the four C's, but it's hitting them on all these different levels because we have four video clips. We've got 50 slide pitch decks. So we've got wonderful pictures. We've got storytelling, which I talk about. I talk about my journey. I talk about other examples. And so I'm really penetrating at least most of the audience because some people are very visual. Some people are more, you know, sort of hands on. More people with the video or with the storytelling. I mean, it's kind of impacting kids on all that different level and stuff. And when they're coming up afterwards and we're doing the book signing, I'm asking them, you know, like, what parts did you like about the presentation? Sometimes they're like, oh, I liked everything, which is cool. And sometimes they're like, I love the storytelling or I loved your example about how hard it is to write, or, you know, I love the story about Star Wars, or I liked the pictures, or I love the videos. And so it's just, it's really impacting most of those students. And when I say most, sometimes it's like, whatever, you know what I mean?
But you're meeting them right where they are though. That's great.
I want to
ask you, we may have to do a second podcast or talk about the rest of the C's, because I want to hone in on something that in the minutes that we have left that you were saying about creativity. It occurs to me, both as a writer and also as the mother of a professional musician, that one of my concerns with creativity these days is that we long for creative arts. We long for art and music and good literature and things like this and great film. And yet at the same time, we live in a society that is offering things like Spotify, which don't, you know, does not compensate an artist, a musician, you know, to the level that that they need to be compensated to, you know, earn a living to feed themselves and a family. Sure. It's like in the world where we have, you know, so much information and things coming at us, our hearts long for creative things, and yet we often don't value as a society, purchasing things. We sort of want to we have so much coming at us for free that we just want to take and never do what we need to do individually to support something like this. So say a little bit about how, you know, something as simple as purchasing a book, like Britfield and the Lost Crown, say, you know, you're a grandma out there and you really want great literature for your family. Something as simple as making a book purchase can really make a difference towards stemming the tide of losing our creative selves and not properly compensating creatives. I think I just answered my own question, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, sure. And I'll just touch on the four C's too. Like it's creativity, communication, critical thinking, and collaboration. So those are the four C's.
There they are.
Yeah, and we weave that through Britfield, and I also bring it into all the presentations, which is exciting. But anyway, that's interesting too, because as you're saying that again, all these thoughts are flying through my mind, and I think on one end, as a nation, it's like we don't have the same kind of impediments that you used to, as far as, you know, getting a book written, getting a book published, getting a book out there. And I could say that same thing for the film industry, which I touched on earlier. It's like, you know, you used to be at the mercy of Hollywood. And Hollywood's kind of like Vegas, you know what I mean? And the house always wins and you don't. But now it's like, you know, you can go out and rent a red camera, you know, or buy one, a used one for like $1,600 or $800 or whatever, and go out and film something and write something and collaborate and get it on YouTube. And it's just so there's a lot of vehicles out there, you know, for the creatives to at least get their art work or their creations out there. And there's a lot of ways to make money, as so many are now, right? I mean, there's the podcasts, there's the YouTubers, there's that are, you know, if you've got something great to say, people will come. And it's going to come down to one thing. It's always going to come down to quality. If it's good enough, you know, it will sell. You know what I mean? If it's good enough, in my opinion, you know, you'll make money from it. Mm-hmm. So don't compromise the quality. Don't go for the quick buck. You know what I mean? Really, whatever you do, do it well, or don't do it at all, and do the best you possibly can. So I think there's a lot of those avenues out there to earn money. I think, yes, you're always going to be fighting against piracy and the freebies. But I think most people respect, you know, purchasing something for quality. You know what I mean? I mean, everyone likes a discount or one likes a sale. But I'm, you know, I still love collecting, you know, signed copies of books, you know, and if I can ever see an author that I like, I don't mind paying the hardcover price because it's a special moment, it's a special book, and it's a special event. I'm older, so maybe a lot of the youth isn't following that, but it's almost like it's kind of like it's a seesaw because on one side it's like you have the piracy or a lot of avenues where people are distributing things for free, or they might actually take your content and distribute it for free, which and what, you know, it's twofold. Like China's a tough one because they don't really have the kind of copyrights that we do, and they'll take something and it's gone. But on the other side of it, it's just like whatever. It's like if a million people are going to read your work, let them read it. I'll make money on this end. You know, United States and some of the, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like where it's going free or being distributed for free. There's other ends where you're making your money. And maybe, you know, ideally you're making it as an author and you're selling your books. But again, too, if you're doing what I'm doing and, you know, you could be making it as a public speaker, you could be making it coming into events and at schools and stuff. And we're not charging for these particular events, but I'm just saying, you know, generally there's a lot of different avenues that one can,
yeah.
or with your own success, you could be a great mentor to other up and coming authors and charge them a fair consulting fee and help them navigate, you know, a lot of things that you've gone through. Mm-hmm. And we do that ourselves. I mean, I've got 10 years of experience within this arena, the publishing in this arena and the marketing arena. But even with that said, we still bring in consultants. And there's one gentleman we're bringing in October. And his series right now is selling 1,000 books a day. So he is doing extremely well. But he's gone through a model for 3.5 years. You know, it wasn't like that 3 years ago. And so the point is, you know, for 4 or 8 hours of his expertise for a price, you know, I'm gaining years of his experience. He's cutting to the chase. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to pay for that. I'm willing to value that kind of insight. So I hope that kind of answered it. But
It does. Yeah. And actually, while you were speaking, I just had the thought of the fact that we have the resurgence of something like vinyl for music, you know, that there's a longing, you know, there's a longing to actually hold something tangible in your hands and to, you know, and to listen to something that, you know, that you could get in other ways. They're choosing now to go back. So it's not just old people, it's young people too. So,
yeah, but check this out for statistics. I just had this conversation this morning and I've had it before too, but you have the book printing industry, which was on a downcline and used to have like 5,000 independent bookstores in the nation. You have about 2,500 that have survived. And now you have an incline of independent bookstores growing at a rate of 5% a year. The paper's coming back also. Kids love to read. They were pushing all this digital and the ebook. The ebook has flatlined at 8 to 10% of the entire market. It's not spiking. They thought it would be 30%. I know from my own surveys of thousands of students, they love reading, but they love the book. They love paperback or hardcover. They want to hold it. They want to read it. They like the bookstores. They don't like going on Amazon. And so I find a lot of things interesting, you know, the irony of it, because if you think the younger generation would be like, yeah, you know what, 30, 40% into the ebooks and on Amazon, and they're not. They like going to the bookstore. They like reading the books. So you like you just said with the vinyl, it's funny, but you see this massive resurgence. I know last year, a lot of publishing companies got in trouble because they had downsized, and all of a sudden they got this surge for paper and paperback books and I think there's been paper shortages in some areas. So it's exciting. I mean, I love it. I love the paperback.
Yeah, it's a great time to be a storyteller. Well, yeah. Our time has gone by so quickly. Chad Stewart, I'm just, I'm so thrilled to let everybody know about Britfield and the Lost Crown. And definitely, friends, you want to go over to the official website at Britfield.com. You can also follow Britfield on Facebook. Just do a search for Official Britfield there on Instagram or Twitter and YouTube. Just check around for Official Britfield, and we'll have links in our show notes at lisahendy.com for you to not only grab the book but also to get involved in finding out how you might bring Chad Stewart to your school or organization as well for a visit with your student. Chad, any kind of closing thoughts before we let you get back to the task of creating?
The world of Britfield, yes. Well, I was going to say, too, we're on Amazon, and what's nice is we've released everything. We have hardcover, softcover, ebook. But we also have audiobook. And the audiobook was done by an award-nominated British voice talent, Ian Russell.
Wow.
And it's awesome. It's like 12 hours. And I think it's like 10 to 12 hours. And he does all the characters. And he's just done an amazing job. So it's kind of a cool thing that if you're driving, you know, on trips, or even if you go into work, you can actually listen to Britfield, you know, through the audio. So we have all those versions on Amazon. We just launched on Amazon about 4 weeks ago, maybe four weeks ago. So
awesome. Awesome. Well, that's great to know. We're so grateful for your time and for creating this beautiful world that we can go into, a world of friendship and family and loyalty and courage. And it's been a real gift to have you on the show this week.
Well, thank you, Lisa. It's great. It's been fun to talk about. I love talking shop.
And come back again when the next installment comes out, will you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're launching, just so you know, like Britfield and the Rise of the Lion, that's book two that takes place in France. It's actually already finished at 540 pages, and we're launching that next year, next fall, 2020. So.
Wonderful. Magnifique. Awesome. That's fantastic. Well, again, friends, that's it for this week's show. It goes by so quickly, but I want to definitely point you to my website, lisahendy.com, where you can get all the information about how to connect with Chad Stewart and learn more about Britfield and The Lost Crown. Definitely one way you can help this podcast is to leave us a star rating or review over at iTunes, or just tell a friend by passing along. Hit that share button on your podcast and tell somebody this week about great literature and creativity. Until next time, I hope you have an awesome week. God bless.
I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. I hope you've enjoyed listening to some of my podcasts here at Breadbox Media, but today I'm speaking to you about a different opportunity. In September 2020, I'll be leading a fantastic pilgrimage cruise from Rome to the Holy Land, and then on the way back, stopping at the cities of St. Paul, Ephesus, Athens, Corinth, and more. While we're at sea, I'll be lecturing on the Gospels, history or mystery. When we're on land, I'll invite you to join me as we visit all of the holy sites, celebrating Mass, worshiping together, and having a wonderful time of fellowship. If you'd like to know more about this pilgrimage cruise, go to my website, dwightlongenecker.com. Go to the right sidebar, and you'll see a picture there, which invites you to get more information. Go to my website, dwightlongenecker.com, right sidebar, click on the picture of the cruise ship, and you'll get all the information you need. Alternatively, you can call the company that's organizing the tour at 800-247-0017. 800-247-0017. Ask for Father Longenecker's Cruise to the Holy Land. Thanks for listening.
Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.